Accession number 18345, Reel 2.
Bill Green, Reel 2.
Yes, well, as I was saying, the troop, known as the number one independent troop, consisted of contingents from the three battalions. There's 21 from the 44th, the rest were from the 4th battalion and the 8th battalion. They were mainly regulars and reservists. And there were three officers with the troop. We were under the command of Major R.E.H. Drury, with Lieutenant Pierce and Second Lieutenant Charles Eade. And we were told that our complement of tanks were following in a cargo ship. And sure enough, a few days later, we were sent down to the docks to unship four Matildas and two Mark 6C light tanks. This was our full complement of tanks for the number one independent troop. Four Matildas and two light tanks. And we were told that our function on Malta was to protect the airfields against possible parachute attack. We then were split into two sections, one section going to cover the Halfar Califrana airfields. There was they were operating from Halfar, and Califrana was a seaplane base. The rest of the troops were covering the one end of Lucca, the fighter aerodrome at Takali. We were always within a few miles of these aerodromes should anything serious happen.
Which one were you in?
I was always on the northern section. Stayed at Birchikara for quite some time. Then we moved to Floriana to be billeted with the Cheshire Regiment in their barracks there. This was always the... we could have got to Lucca and Takali quite easily from there. We put up our own Sangers to hide the tanks from spotter aircraft, we then showed the flag for a couple of months. The Maltese public were, of course, new to the war. They'd been bombed quite a lot by the Italians, and of course just after we arrived the Germans entered the theatre and made it very, very uncomfortable. So as a bit of a flag waving exercise, we took the tanks around the island more or less to give the islanders a bit of confidence, to show that we weren't neglecting them, that we were not leaving them to their fate. So then, of course, that proved to be a good idea, but not very practical, because they're very thirsty things, their tanks, and we were using up quite an awful lot of very hard to get diesel, which of course we had to start to think about conserving it. And it was no surprise to us that they were semi-mothballed for huge tracts of time while we were volunteered for any chore that happened to be wanting bodies. And we built blast shelters, we drove civilian transport and army transport to get the stuff off the convoys, because through 41 we were getting fairly regular convoys, so we used to have to go down. Some of the lads even did stevedoring on the actual cargo ships that came in. In fact, it was considered to be a nice little perk away from the daily soldierly routine to drive the stuff on the convoys. And we used to go down and queue up for the load, and then take it out into the countryside where there were specialised dumps well away from the built-up area, so that they didn't offer targets for the Luftwaffe. And then, of course, we had that mammoth task of building protection pens for the for the aircraft there, because we had seen so many flown in off the aircraft carriers, and the Germans would allow them the time to get on the ground to refuel and then come over and wipe the lot up. And it was no surprise when something had to be done about it, and they started this construction of the pens. So we worked on the pens. I was at Takali. By that time we were under canvas at Vidala Palace. That was up near Rabat. And it was a nice camp. It was well away from any aerial activity, and we could soon get down to Takali from there. And we laboured on Takali until it was fully penned, and of course it started to prove of benefit, because they were not putting out anywhere near the number of aircraft on the ground as we'd seen previously. It was a very good idea. However, the old Maltese stone weighed a ton, and anyway, I think we did a very good job on them, really, but it was very, very hard work, and of course by that time we weren't getting fed all that well.
It was like dry stone walling, was it?
Well, it was more or less the bombed houses from Valletta and Floriana. And Maltese stone is very similar to Bath stone. It's a soft stone, you can saw it. And of course it was in great big blocks. So ours looked very professional, but some of them were made of those 4-gallon petrol tins full of sand, and they looked rather crude, but they did the job. They withstood blast and certainly strafing.
Were there conditions of privation there?
I don't think we felt the privation until sometime in 42, when I forgot to mention that in the January of 42 we were reinforced from the Middle East. The 6th tanks sent a squadron. I think the number of tanks they sent were 18. They were on two ships, and one ship got across with 9 cruisers and light tanks on. The other had bomb damage. They were coming to us from Alexandria. The other ship, the Thermopylae, was hit, and put into harbour, was patched up, and they tried again a few days later, and it got a bomb right through the engine room via one of its funnels, and it sank, and three of the tank contingent died. So they didn't try again. The survivors were sent back to the battalion, and we had just the one shipload. But the nine tanks were gave us a bit of confidence that we weren't on our own, and we had some very soldierly quality material had come with the, because it was a regular battalion, and there's always something you can tell between a wartime soldier and a regular. There's just that bit of difference, and a couple of them had won MMs at earlier battles in the desert, so we welcomed them, as did we welcome the CO that came with them, a Major Longworth, and he was a very nice person. Very nice officer. We got along with him splendidly, and we were rather pleased to see our other CO disappear quickly. And we'd hardly got that lot sorted out, and they started to cut the rations. And I should say that for 4 or 5 months we were on fairly low intake of food, and I didn't suffer all that much because I was only 9'4" at the time, but I went down to just under 8". But it was the big men that that showed it more. We had one rather huge chap by the name of Murphy, and his battle dress just hung on him. Strangely, I thought the Maltese would really turn on us due to the privations they were suffering, more or less on our behalf. But they astounded me at their stoicism. They really did. And it was nothing if we were going past their bakeries you know, that they'd give us a chunk of bread when they were so short of it themselves. We had a remarkable cook corporal who they say used to sleep in his store at night so that he wouldn't get anything burgled. And he was very, very fair in his distribution, and nobody had more than anybody else. It was remarkable how some people came to terms with the issue of bread, which was a slice and a half. Some used to eat it in one go, some used to make it last twice, and others would cut it into cubes and have it on the hour. It was very strange to see how they all had a personal idea of how to beat their hunger.
Is that the daily ration?
That was the daily ration, yes, yes. And we had the inevitable M&V. I did very, very well because my friend, a North London lad, he used to be physically ill if he ate M&V stew. It was just something in his makeup. He just couldn't eat it. So I always had his portion, and I used to give him some of my bread. So we survived. We survived. And, of course, it was only the Santa Maria convoy, that Operation Pedestal, that turned the corner for us.
Did you see any of the convoys come in?
Yes, I did. I saw it from the bastions. I went down to Florian and saw them come in.
What sights do you remember from the convoys?
Well, the bits and pieces, the bomb damage, the shrapnel damage. See the Ohio coming in, strapped to the two destroyers.
What, did any of the bombs fall near you?
When? At any time during the siege?
At any time during the siege?
Yes, we had several near misses. We had lots of near misses when we were doing the pens on the runway. I personally was in Sleema one night in Tuck H or the Salvation Army hostel, sleeping overnight because I had a pass, and it took a house away three from me. People say, well, I had no right to be sleeping through it, but at times you got rather blasé about it, which was rather silly. I also used to use the big garage that did the repairs on our tanks. If we had, I forgot to tell you that the troop was absolutely self-contained. We had our own fitters, we had our own spares. It was a troop that could have lived anywhere within itself. We had we were completely self-contained, and the only thing we couldn't do was engine changes. And of course, we had a big garage, Mamo's garage in Gezira, and that used to do our engine changes. Consequently, two of our fitters were there. And I often used to use one of their beds to save me, going all the way back to camp. As long as I got in for 8 o'clock in the morning for roll call, it was all right. So I copped a little bit of near misses while I was there, but that would have been my own fault. We were strafed on a couple of occasions by fighter aircraft. This was on a push bike. We had the army push bikes, which was more or less our standard transport to get from here to there, so that we didn't take a truck out and the consequence of the petrol. One day we were, two of us were going from Vidala Palace to Valletta. And we were coming down a big stretch, and we had a little inkling that there was something happening. And we turned round, and there was a fighter aircraft in the distance coming for us. So we went straight off the road, and it flashed its guns all the way down the road. That was the only personal thing that ever happened to me. The rest of it was more or less by remote control. So nothing really alarming.
Did you make friends with Maltese?
Yes, very much so. In fact, I had a Maltese girlfriend for quite some time there, and her family were very, very nice. In the early days, I tried to take them as much food as I could get from oversupply of rations. This was in the easier stages of our stay in Malta. And they were very nice. Most of the men picked up some sort of liaison with a family. Our cook, Corporal Ernie Down, he had a great relationship with a Maltese family who were bakers. Nearly everybody had somewhere that they could either meet or... They were a remarkable race. I naturally assumed that they were going to, be very stroppy about the punishment they were taking, but they weren't. They hated the Italians. Oh, there was such hatred.
Why was that?
Well, I think they lived cheek by jowl with the Italians for years, and I'm sure some of them were sort of mixed blood. And a lot of Italians worked on Malta, a lot of Maltese worked in Italy. There was quite a link with the people on Sicily. I think they were very more surprised than anything that their erstwhile friends had turned on them. I think that's a very naive explanation, but it's the nearest I can get.
What was the army's attitude towards marriages between soldiers and Maltese?
I don't think there was an awful lot of resistance from the powers that be. Most of the regiments that were on Malta were regular regiments. I think they got used to their soldiers marrying people at various overseas postings. I know our CO wasn't at all keen on it, but and I think he sort of advised against it, only from the view that, well, we may not be here much longer point of view, which was of course a moot point, and a point really worth considering. And of course eventually we did go.
When was that?
It wasn't until the July of 1943. It was we were glad of the time actually, because we got our health together after the life-saving convoy. We had a couple in quick succession after that, restoring our rations to where they were before, and we gradually got better and better and better. And we were expecting to go any time actually after the siege was lifted, but the Germans were still in Sicily. Although going back, it was one of our best times. Our honeymoon period was the time when they attacked Russia, because the whole of the Luftwaffe left Sicily and went off to join in a different theatre of war. So it was very nice. And of course this happened two or three times, where the bomber squadrons in Italy and Sicily were bled to make up for losses on the Russian front. So you could say that after the life-saving convoy, the air raids, they had one last fling. They had one last fling, and it was a terrific raid. And it was the mummy and daddy of all raids on the Grand Harbour. I've never seen anything like it before. But we were seeing a different type of Luftwaffe to what we'd seen before. They had evidently heard of the ACAC that could be put up by the harbour defences, and it really was fearsome. It really was fearsome. And you would see, from memory, and I can see it very clearly, there was a Vic of five JU-87s coming into the box barrage, and they peeled off as they always did, follow my leader, and they were coming down. And from the five that came down, the first one was coming down minus its wings, the second one was coming through, the third one just vanished. The fourth one came down and got away with it, and the fifth one veered off. The fifth one didn't even come down through it, he came down through the side of it. And I think they suffered so badly that day that they never attempted it again. And from then on, it became very, very patchy, but no very, very concentrated attack. So we had a recuperation period, and then we noticed the activity in the harbour. And this was the July of 43. And of course, hindsight told us what it was, that it was the start of the invasion of Sicily. And it is an irony, even to this day for me, that as I was leaving Lucca Airport in a Dakota for the Middle East, my regiment was about to attack Sicily. So as I was leaving, they were coming. So we must, at one period, have crossed each other. We flew to El Adam, near Tobruk, refueled, went on to Cairo West, and then by transport to Abbasiyah Barracks in Cairo.
What happened to you there?
Well, we were resented, really. We certainly weren't made welcome. The war had long since departed from Cairo, and the base was full of what I would call regimental rejects, or possibly, not to be too naughty to some of the people, they may have been wounded and downgraded, but certainly there was no welcome extended to us. Not that we thought we were hail the conquering hero comes, but at least we'd been used to a little bit of friendliness amongst our contemporaries, and to be snarled at, shouted at and bawled at like six-month-old recruits, we rather resented it. So it was decided that we would get out of there as rapidly as we could, which was possibly their idea.
Where did you go to?
Well, one day we saw on the notice board that the 9th Armoured Brigade, which had always had its own armoured car regiment attached to it when it fought at Alamein, were going to build up their own recce troops, have their own recce troops. Well, a recce troop would be approximately 60 men. And so that was three regiments in the brigade, the Warwickshire Yeomanry, Wiltshire Yeomanry and 3rd Hussars, were going to have their own recce troops. So I said to my couple of friends that I stayed with on Malta, and got rather close to, how about it? And they said yes, so we chose the Warwickshire Yeomanry. And they were stationed in Palestine at a little kibbutz called Pardes Hanna, mostly orange groves, and lovely, lovely green, verdant village it was. They'd really reclaimed it from the desert. It was so well tended.